for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Big money, an estimated $379 million, is being spent this year on governor's races. The 36 gubernatorial contests include 11 incumbents in serious jeopardy. Joining me to talk about the governor's races coming down to the wire and their national implications, Stuart Rothenberg of the Rothenberg Political Report, Jennifer Duffy of the Cook Political Report, joining us by phone from Charlottesville, Virginia, Larry Sabato of the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia, and from a studio at KWMU in St. Louis, Alan Greenblatt of Governing Magazine. I know you'll want to weigh in. Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter, and welcome to all of you.
Thanks very much.
Good to have you all with us. Stu Rothenberg, I'm going to start with you. Lots of attention on these races, but still more attention on the Senate. But tell us what's going on with the governors.
Well, there are 22 Republican governors up this year and 14 Democrats overall. There are 29 Republican governors in the states and 21 Democrats, so that there are more Republican governors overall and also dramatically more in this class. Remember, Diane, this is the same class that was elected 4 years ago, 2010, a big Republican wave, not only in the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate, but also in the states. So there's a lot of states up. It's very important because the states have become laboratories not only for ideas, but also for politicians who want to be national political figures and, of course, run for the White House. Plus, there's all this talk about gridlock in Washington. And if Washington can't work, somebody's got to work. And often that's put at the doorstep of governors, states, and state legislators. So I think there should be a significant amount of attention to governors. There is less so, I think, for a couple of reasons. One is when you look at the Senate, one party or the other controls the institutions. Governors, it's different. They run individual states, and so it's harder to say, well, there's a gain or a loss or who's winning control. It's really not a case of who's going to win control of governors. It's who's going to be elected to those offices.
So, Jennifer, take us back to 2012. How does this compare?
Well, you know, 2012, there are so many fewer races. There are only 12 states that actually elect governors in a presidential year. By and large, sometimes it goes with the presidential, sometimes not. You had some surprises. You know, President Obama lost North Carolina by a couple points. The Republican won North Carolina by a couple of points. Yet, you know, President Obama lost Missouri by a good bit, and you saw a Democratic governor get reelected. So they tend to exist in their own universe, and they don't get very much attention, that's for sure.
Larry Sabato, how important is partisanship in these races?
Well, it's very important, but it's not as important as it is in races for the Senate. Yes, Jennifer was just saying, individual governor's races tend to run on different tracks. They don't get as much attention nationally, but within the state, they often dominate the coverage because people know they're electing a singular executive for the next 2 or 4 years, and they're governed by that individual. They know when they elect a senator, the senator is one of 100, and there's collective responsibility. But, you know, we make the argument at our crystal ball site that the governorships are a much better measure of where the country is and what the country's thinking this year. And there's a very fundamental reason for it. There are 35 Senate races, but because they're concentrated this year in smaller states for the most part, only 51% of Americans have the opportunity to vote for one of those 35 Senate seats. Contrast that with the 36 governorships that are up. almost 80% of the American people are voting for governor. So when we're looking for lessons from 2014, we might actually start with the governorships, not the Senate.
So, Alan Greenblatt, how do you respond to that?
Well, one thing I've been thinking about is whether this is kind of a referendum election, in that while Washington has been totally gridlocked, very dysfunctional, the states have been pushing a lot of ambitious policies, but in different directions. We have single-party control in most states, meaning Republicans or Democrats have both the governorship and the legislature. And in the red states, Republican states, they've been very ambitious with abortion restrictions, with tax cuts, with voter ID laws. And if you're living in a blue state, you're living in politically in a very different world. You're seeing your minimum wage probably increased. You're seeing expansion of Medicaid coverage under the Affordable Care Act, which is up to states' discretion, and maybe seeing some restrictions on gun owners' rights. So the states and have been going in these opposite directions, and I think for a lot of these governors, one reason they're in trouble is that some of them may have gone farther than their voters wanted.
I simply want to add, well, I see Larry's point, and I agree partially with it. I think there's one difference, the governor's races versus Senate races, in an area where governor's races may not be as instructive as looking at the Senate or the House. And that's this. Governor's races are, in a sense, like presidential contests, where personality, the individual style of the governor, is very important. Sure, the ideology and the agenda and how successful the governor's been on the economy or education, those are all very important. Of course, we'll pay attention to that. But a lot of some of these governors who got elected, when I look at how they've performed over 4 years, you wonder how they seem politically tone deaf sometimes. I'll give you Corbett in Pennsylvania, just can't communicate with the state. Rick Scott in Florida is not a natural politician. Snyder, Governor Snyder in Michigan is not a natural. You know, there are some politicians. Bill Clinton, there was a case of the natural politician. So some of these governors, it's about their personality and style.
Jennifer.
You know, I'd also add that one of the threads that I can weave through most of the of our very vulnerable incumbents is the economy. A lot of these governors are in states where the economy has not recovered as it has in some others. There are a couple of exceptions to that, but when you look at a Connecticut, for example, an Illinois, Wisconsin, Michigan, they haven't really kept up, and I think that that is feeding voters dissatisfaction with some of these incumbents. Look at Connecticut now. Dan Malloy, the governor, Democrat, promised in the campaign that he would not raise taxes. Well, within 6 months, he instituted the largest tax increase in the state's history.
And how did he justify that?
He justified that as we have a big budget hole to fill and we have to raise taxes or cut education. Unfortunately, there are people in Connecticut who believe they did both. But as a result, he's very unpopular. I'd say that the same is true for Pat Quinn in Illinois. He instituted an enormous tax increase that he said would be temporary. Now he's kind of hinting it might be permanent. Rick Snyder, Michigan, Republican, has actually done some very interesting, innovative things in the state, but they haven't. It hasn't moved forward as much as they would like, which explains, you know, why he's in trouble. And he is not a natural politician. He runs as one tough nerd is his tagline. So he's a computer guy.
So Larry Sabato, what about a tough nerd running for governor as opposed to somebody who really appeals to the people?
Well, he managed to win, of course, in a heavily Republican year, and so far he's doing reasonably well, but he's not doing exceptionally well. Why? Because Michigan is a blue state. The Senate race there, at least at our crystal ball side, we put to bed many months ago. There was very little chance the Republican was going to win the Senate race there. Now, why isn't the Democrat winning the Michigan governorship? There's a fairly strong Democrat, former congressman, running against Governor Snyder. The answer is that while governorship elections are still partisan, they're not as partisan in many cases as the Senate races are. You're able to get a Republican elected in a Democratic state for governor a lot more easily than you can do that for a Senate seat and vice versa. And that's probably a good thing, because the issues that governors focus on are much less the social issues that often dominate the TV ads for senator, you know, about abortion and gay marriage and this, that, and the other. They're focused on education, transportation, where the rubber meets the road. There's an old saying, senators talk and governors do, and that's a fundamental distinction.
So, Alan Greenblatt, then, why does the party affiliation of a state governor matter to the country at large?
Well, I think it matters because they pursue different policies. The states have become more partisan. Larry's right. Governors are not as partisan in tone or in approach as senators or members of Congress, but they have become actually more partisan. They're more likely to attack each other. And as Stu alluded, some of these guys see themselves as future presidents, and the Republican side in particular has a wide open field. A lot of governors will be going to Iowa and New Hampshire and touting their ability to balance budgets without cutting taxes, their ability to prevail in blue states, their ability to do things like Scott Walker's famous four in Wisconsin to end collective bargaining rights for most public employees.
I remember talking to Barack Obama before he became president. He told me that there's not a member of the Senate or a governor's state house that doesn't look in the mirror every single morning and say, maybe I could be president. We're going to take a short break here and take your calls when we come back. Join us, 800-433-8850. And if you just joined us, we're talking about the 36 governors up for re-election. 11 of them are in very tight races. During the break, Jennifer Duffy, you were talking about how during these races, people, some governors tried to diminish other governors in their search for the White House.
Well, true. I think that the Democratic Party in particular have their sights on three or four governors who, if they do not win re-election, obviously you cannot run for president.
Such as?
Governor Walker in Wisconsin, Governor Snyder in Michigan. They tried against Governor Kasich in Ohio. That didn't work. But even they have one more in their sights, and that's Governor Christie. Who is chairman of the Republican Governors Association. He sort of bears the responsibility for the number of seats won or lost, and I think that they would like to damage his prospects further, narrow the field some.
Stu Rothenberg,
I certainly agree. I mean, this goes to the point that these Elections are not even just in a two-year period. An election cycle has become like 4 years, 8 years, 12 years as each party looks ahead. And I would just add to Jennifer's point, she's entirely correct. Just look at what the Republican operatives now say about Hillary Clinton. I mean, they are doing the same thing.
Oh, sure.
It's not about this November. It's about the following November and the one after that.
And to you, Larry Sabato, what are some of the states that could actually flip from one party to another? We've already seen Neil Abercrombie, Democrat in Hawaii, lose his primary.
Yes, and by the way, there's a lot of potential because we have the largest number of governors, 28, running for re-election this year in over 50 years. And it would have been 29 had Abercrombie not lost his primary. So you have a tremendous opportunity for incumbents to lose. 11 of them are in trouble. If all 11 lost, it would tie the modern record, which was back in 1962 when 11 governors lost, 5 Democrats and 6 Republicans. And by the way, I think there's going to be a mix, Democrat and Republican losing, incumbents losing. I don't think it's going to be a clear pattern on one side or another.
Tell me about Tom Corbett, the Republican in Pennsylvania.
Well, we felt so certain about Corbett almost a year ago. We weighted the race against him, which we've never done for an incumbent governor in his first term before the opposition had even picked a candidate. And Corbett doesn't have a personal scandal. He was felt to handle the Penn State matter badly. And in addition to that, he never really connected with the Republican legislature. He doesn't have a lot of accomplishments. He can say that there's a much better economy. I've been surprised he hasn't driven that message home more. But we also have to remember Pennsylvania is a blue state. Republicans are often fooled into thinking that it's purple or even occasionally reddish, and it really isn't. So I think Corbett has a basket of problems that are unique to him. I think he was probably the first incumbent governor that everybody wrote off. Abercrombie was second.
What do you think, Jeff?
Well, you know, interestingly enough, governors are supposed to be the bright spot for Democrats on election night. But I tend to agree with Larry that I think we're going to get a very mixed bag. I mean, we've even got this is the most incumbents we have ever had in toss-up in 30 years of rating races. But at the same time, you know, we've got some Democratic open seats that are in toss-up that are interesting. Massachusetts, for example. Is
because
an open seat.
Oh, Patrick is not running.
He is not running for re-election.
Why is he not running?
You know, it's hard to do a third four-year term. He said when he announced it was a promise he made to his wife that he was going to make good on. You know, that, yes, Abercrombie lost in Hawaii. So now you've got a very interesting three-way race in Hawaii, and Republicans have a shot at that. So what is supposed to be Democrats' bright spot may be a very mixed bag.
Alan Greenblatt, I want to go back to Pennsylvania for just a moment. Tom Corbett, as Larry has said, has a Republican legislature behind him. Any chance that a Democrat could be elected governor?
Well, we do expect that the Democrat, Tom Wolf, will be elected governor there. And that raises a point which I think will be very interesting in the next couple of years, which is that if some of these challengers win, they're going to have legislatures that are of the opposite party. You know, the Democrat looks like he's in pretty good shape, Paul Davis, to knock off Sam Brownback in Kansas. That legislature will be still very Republican. In Massachusetts, if Charlie Baker, the Republican, does win, that legislature is going to be 80% Democratic. My guess is, especially in Pennsylvania, if you have a new governor come in from a new party facing the legislature controlled by the other party, we're going to see Washington-style gridlock in more of these states. We've had, as I said earlier, single-party control in all but a dozen states. They've been really moving on a lot of policies, but I think we may see a bit of a brake put on all that.
Stu.
You know, I agree entirely. I mean, and the point was made earlier by Larry and or Jennifer. These governors' races traditionally are less ideological. But what we're seeing is into the seeping into the state capitals, the governors, state legislatures. The what we see in D.C. is filtering out there, the partisanship, the bitterness, the conflict. Pennsylvania legislature actually has been evenly divided, narrowly divided for a long time. I remember when I taught at Bucknell in the whenever that was, whatever century that was, in the late 70s. I mean, they used to have these legislative fights on appropriations and spending right to the end. But I do think here's one little area of disagreement on Pennsylvania. I think it's a huge deal that the Democrats are going to win the governorship because there's what I call the iron law of Pennsylvania governorships. Diane, whereby one party has held the governorship for 8 years, and then switches to the other party, and then the other party, and then the other party, going back to World War II. Huh. So this is going to break that trend. This is a 60, 70-year-old trend. And I think there's a reason for that. If you're governor of Pennsylvania, it's a big state, many media markets. The Philadelphia folks don't like the Pittsburgh folks. The Pittsburgh folks don't like the Philadelphia folks. And they don't know that they don't know that the center of the state exists even. They never heard of Harrisburg. So it's difficult to knock off a sitting governor who can raise so much money and has so much presence. So I think it's a big deal that Democrats are going to own governorship.
Larry, I know you wanted to jump in.
I agree with what Stuart said. It is a big deal, but iron laws are made to be broken, and these iron laws are created by us analysts. I don't think voters focus on whether one party's been in for 8 years and needs to be changed. But I'll tell you the one I'm focusing on that I think does reinforce the point Stu made and Alan and Jennifer, Florida. Now, let's say that Charlie Crist benefits enough from Fangate to be able to beat the one-term Republican incumbent Rick Scott. And, Crist was already doing well. The polls are tied. After all, he's a tripartisan. He's been a Republican, independent, a Democrat. The guy is deeply tanned. That plays in Florida. Let's say he's elected. Not only does he get a heavily Republican legislature, they're going to be out for blood. Because he switched parties, and they really dislike him personally, many of the legislative leaders. So that is going to be ground zero for hyper-partisanship at the state level.
All right. I'm going to open the phones, take some calls, 800-433-8850. First to Sycamore, Illinois. Hamish, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
Thank you very much for your show. There isn't anybody that does it better than you do.
Thank you so much, sir.
Okay. We have a Democrat and a Republican and running for office. And my problem is the Republican candidate is buying the office. He's using his own money. And somebody that buys the office does not represent me or anyone else. It's just not the way to go. We definitely have problems here, but having somebody buy the office doesn't solve the problem.
How different is Illinois from any other state, Jennifer?
Well, it's interesting. We've seen candidates put money into, gubernatorial races, Senate races, House races. By and large, I think the callers in the minority, voters mostly don't care. What Bruce Rauner, the Republican, is referring to is saying is by funding it himself, he's beholden to no one, which in Illinois is he believes is a big deal, since he believes that the Democratic governor is beholden to everyone. And so that's part of it. But Democrats have done a very good job of turning Bruce Rauner into Romney 2.0, only meaner. So that's good. That's a tough race, given Quinn's numbers, you would think that he would be where Tom Corbett is now, but they've managed to keep this race very competitive.
Alan Greenbatt, do you want to comment?
Well, that's happening also in the Connecticut race. There's a wealthy businessman, Tom Foley, running against Dan Malloy, the incumbent Democrat, and they're doing that exact same strategy of Romney, the heartless businessman. Foley owns a 116-foot yacht. He doesn't understand your problems. And those states are blue enough that those weak incumbents may just eke it out. But I think, you know, I was just talking to somebody yesterday about Wisconsin, where Mary Burke is a Democratic challenger. She comes from a wealthy background, and people seem to like that. They like that idea of the person who is beholden to no one, who is self-funded. Tom Wolf, the Democrat who we're touting as the likely next governor of Pennsylvania, he's put $10 million of his own money into the race. I mean, there's plenty of money sloshing around in these races, some of it from the candidates themselves.
Diana, I found that when people complain about a candidate trying to buy an election, usually they favor the other candidate and the other party. I remember when John Corzine went into New Jersey and sprinkled money around. I remember when Herb Kohl, who recently retired from the Senate from Wisconsin, said, I'm going to spend my own money because I'm not going to be beholden to anyone, just as Jennifer says. So this is really, I think, you know, maybe the caller does not like the idea of a candidate spending money, but mostly it's an excuse to support one candidate or the other.
But Larry Sabato, are we seeing more money in this term race than we've ever seen before?
Diane, I can tell you the automatic answer to that question that's asked every 2 years is yes.
Yes.
Always yes.
Just keeps going up.
We never know exactly how much more, but it's always a lot more. You know, I had to chuckle a little bit in listening to the others mention some of these wealthy candidates. At least Stu and I are old enough to remember when the wealthy candidates used to turn that into a plus, the fact that they were spending their own money.
Sure.
The slogan would frequently be, I'm nobody's man but yours.
Exactly. And that is the voice of Larry Sabato of the University of Virginia Center for Politics. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's go back to the phones to James. He's in Cleveland, Ohio. Hi there.
Good morning. How is everyone?
Just fine, thanks.
Love your show, Diane. It's
Thank
a fabulous
you.
Show.
Thank you.
Since you guys have been talking, I'm going to augment just a little bit, but I will be quick. My first one was going to be about how does everyone feel that the so-called gerrymandering will impact the election? And then secondly, I want to ask everybody what the people who are spending their own money and therefore aren't beholden to anybody, what don't we know that we all think we do know because they are spending their own money? And the last one, I'll leave that one out for another time.
All right. Thanks a lot. Stu, what about gerrymandering?
Well, this doesn't affect governor's races as much as it affects the fight for the House of Representatives. There's been a lot of talk over the past few years about how these districts are drawn to elect certain candidates from one party to the other. They empower the most ideological, most partisan elements of a particular party.
But how does
party.
That affect governor's races?
It doesn't. As a matter of fact, governor's races can affect gerrymandering to the extent that in most states, governors have a role
right.
in the redistricting reapportionment process. But we still have a half dozen years before we have to worry about that. Or actually, we start worrying about it well before the census and the new lines are drawn. So, but we still have another couple of years, don't you think, Jennifer?
I think we can take a break for 2 years.
Larry Sabato, what about the money don't we know?
Well, I think very little, and here's why. One of the great growth industries in political consultancy has been opposition research, often shortened to OPPO research, and each major party candidate, at least in the competitive races, can spend millions investigating the opponent. Everything the opponent and the key members of his family have done all the way back to kindergarten. And if there's anything there on the public record or that they can obtain in surreptitious ways, believe me, we'll find out about it. Either they put it in a TV ad, or if it's really nasty, they will leak it to a blog or a reporter who'll do their dirty work for them.
Jennifer.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. Larry's absolutely right. You know, opposition research is such that one of the Democrats' taglines in their ads against Bruce Rauner is, did he think we wouldn't find out?
Find out what?
Well, mostly about his business dealings. But I mean, that is the tagline. So there's very little about these candidates you don't know, except maybe what they ordered for dinner last night.
And the video tracker may get that. We may even know that.
Exactly. Let's go to BJ in Sarasota, Florida. Quick question, BJ.
Yes, quick question. We certainly are learning nothing from all of the TV ads except who has the most money to run them. I'm wondering what Professor Sabato and others think about eliminating television ads from TV like we did cigarette ads.
I want to go first to Alan Greenblatt for your comment on that.
Well, my comment is I don't think that's a plausible idea. What we've seen in the last 10, 20 years is that money finds its way into politics. Whatever restrictions you put on it, people find a way. And free speech certainly will allow people to make their positions known on TV or otherwise.
Larry.
Well, having grown up in the era of poll taxes and literacy tests, I'm not in favor of any kind of test in order to vote, and certainly not banning television ads. It would be a First Amendment violation. But if I could persuade people not to vote, it would be on account of one thing. If they believe the charges they see in the TV ads, that's a good indication they haven't done their homework and they shouldn't cast a ballot. And I'm really quite serious about that. The charges in many of these TV ads are absolutely outrageous. Organizations like PolitiFact do a fine job in testing them. But, of course, very few people read PolitiFact. They don't know what the truth is.
Larry Sabato of the University of Virginia and the author of The Kennedy Half Century. Short break here. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Lumosity, with a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving to calculate baseline scores. More at Lumosity.com. By Inada, maker of the Dream Wave Massage Chair, with body scanning technology and shiatsu point detection. Learn more at DreamWaveChair.com. And by Vicky and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offer solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. This is NPR.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Morning Edition co-host David Green recently traveled 6,000 miles across Russia on the Trans-Siberian Railroad. NPR's former Moscow bureau chief on the lives of ordinary Russians and their mixed views about democracy. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we've got lots of callers, lots of emails. We'll try to get to as many as we can. Here's a question about the Texas gubernatorial race from Evan, who says poll after poll shows Wendy Davis trailing Greg Abbott. But isn't a big part of Ms. Davis' strategy to activate people not typically likely voters, and therefore people who are unlikely to be polled? How can we assess how successful her campaign and other get-out-the-vote efforts have been to date, Jennifer?
Well, I mean, first of all, these are public polls that he's talking about. But trust me, the parties, the candidates poll on a whole set of scenarios, and Republicans have polled on her assumptions, and they don't get a much different answer. It's, you know, this is Democrat Senate strategy, right, is to motivate these what they call drop-off voters. There is such a belief among Democrats that Texas is so close to turning purple, on its way to being blue. But the reality is we're pretty far away from that. You're going to see Arizona, maybe Georgia, turn blue before you're going to see Texas turn blue.
What do you think,
people,
Steve?
People from the minority party, that is the smaller party in a state, always talk about registering voters, turning out voters, bringing out new voters. You hear this all the time. This is one of those races. There's always a couple of races, aren't there, Jennifer, okay, where kind of national media attention gets certain people all excited, but it just was never there. She's trailing 8, 10, 12, 15 points in poll after poll. You have to understand, when you register voters and turn them out, even if they're not traditional voters, you're just talking about a percentage point or two here. You can't turn a state around. You can't recolor a state. And she is just running in the wrong state at the wrong time. Maybe 20 years from now, 10 years from now, she'd win. But it's not there now.
All right. And Larry Sabato, during the break, we were talking about political ads and whether they actually change people's minds. What do you think?
I think in a midterm election, they're used more to motivate the bases than they are to change people's minds. They try to get the Democratic base or the Republican base energized and activated to vote, and sometimes they do it by telling them pleasant things about their own candidate, but mainly they tell them unpleasant things about the other candidate. That's the difference. I just want to add on Texas, Davis has been such a disaster in the election that not a single Democrat is going to win statewide office in Texas. Maybe if she'd been a better candidate, one or two might have popped through, or maybe not, but none of them are going to win. And I second what Jennifer said. Georgia is going to turn blue well before Texas.
Okay, but Larry, I need your analysis of why you think she's been such a bad candidate.
Well, she doesn't fit the electorate in Texas. A lot of this is purely ideological. They simply disagree with her, the electorate, the dominant electorate in Texas. This is still a deeply red state. You know, Rick Perry, governor for life, elected over and over again. Ted Cruz, even John Cornyn, who is certainly quiescent compared to some of the other statewide Texans, is a very conservative vote in the Senate.
All right. Let's talk about the main gubernatorial election, Alan Greenblatt.
Well, this is a fascinating one. Paula Page is the Republican incumbent. He snuck in 4 years ago. It was a three-way race. He got about 39% of the vote. The independent, L.A. Cutler, finished second in front of the Democrat. The Democrat ran a weak campaign, and her support imploded and went to Cutler. So the question all year has been, there are people in Maine who have bumper stickers saying 61%. In other words, they're part of the big majority that does not like LePage. He's very brash. He's sort of a Tea Party figure in a lightly blue state. The question is, can the Democrat, who's Congressman Mike Michaud, capture the bulk of that support? So far, most of the polls suggest he can. Cutler, the independent, who came in second last time, is running again. I think the last couple polls will tell the tale. If Cutler is still looking strong, he'll probably retain some of that strength. But more likely, if he's looking like he's going to finish third anyway, I think Michaud will bring that one home for the Democrats.
Okay, quick tweet from Sarah. Is Virginia the only state with a one-term limit?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
quick tweet from Keith. All of your panelists saying Governor Kasich is sure to win election in Ohio.
Yes, I think we're all saying that. He's got a huge lead. Yes. The Democratic nominee has imploded over a, I guess, would we call it a personal scandal or questions about personal behavior that occurred years ago, and it's just turned this race that we expected to be a really competitive, interesting, close race into an absolute laugher. And it may well catapult Kasich to a presidential bid.
All right, to Caitlin in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Hi. I just had a quick comment about our current governor. He actually has done quite a few policy things that I think would be more associated with a Democratic governor, such as the Medicaid expansion. And he has really knocked heads with the Republicans in the House and the Senate, the state House and Senate over that. And I think that that has been affecting his ability to get some of his base to come around.
Larry Sabato.
Was she referring to Michigan?
Yeah.
Well, Rick Snyder is generally seen as a more moderate Republican. He certainly doesn't have the hard edges of, say, a Scott Walker in Wisconsin or certainly some of the southern Republican governors. And he has to. Look, from the very beginning, I'm sure he realized he was representing a blue state. And to get reelected, he would at least have to win the people in the middle. The purple voters combined with the red voters can equal a narrow majority in Michigan.
Yeah, well, I think Caitlin is extremely astute assessment of that race. It's funny, the polls show the race quite close, and yet when I talk to Republican operatives, they're really quite confident that they're going to win that state. So I think that they think that the late deciders, the people who haven't committed yet, really are going to go for the governor.
And here's an email on that same state from Catherine in Grand Rapids. She says, Michigan is not necessarily a blue state, Ann Arbor, Detroit. Its surrounding suburbs are deep blue. They outnumber the rest of the state, which is very red. In statewide elections, we vote Democrat because of Detroit and Ann Arbor. But if it were not a winner-take-all state, the Republican would get the most Electoral College vote, which is why our state legislature is trying to change it. As Grand Rapids rises in influence, the state gets redder. Alan Greenblatt.
Well, that's right. There's some states that have sort of objected to our electoral college system, and legislatures have talked, not just there, but in Pennsylvania, other states, because we have this phenomenon. Democrats tend to live in dense communities, the more populous suburbs and the big cities, and that's true in state after state. The Wisconsin governor's race is all about Madison and Milwaukee versus the rest of the state. We don't vote by county anymore, so if you have more people, that's how you win statewide. But it does. That's also an aspect of the polarization of our politics. You know, we really don't have so much red and blue states as very red and blue counties that are struggling for influence. And in some places, that's playing out in these races. You know, in Colorado, Democrats have the legislative majority. A lot of those legislators are from Denver and Boulder, and they push through certain gun control restrictions and environmental laws that John Hickenlooper, the Democratic governor, signed. And even though he's mainly tried to position himself as a centrist, that is what is causing him a lot of problems in the rest of the state. You know, I think it was 11 or 13 counties in Colorado held votes last year on whether to secede. So people don't always like the dominant politics of their state. They feel outnumbered.
And what about Kansas, Stu Rothenberg?
Wow. one of the most Republican state in the nation, Sam Brownback, is in the fight of his life. He's alienated members of his own party by trying to defeat them in primaries. He has angered the education establishment. What's happening in Kansas, both the Senate race and the governor's race, is remarkable. If you think, put it in the context of this election cycle, where it's all about President Obama. There's a significant breeze behind the Republicans and at their back. And here, in one of the most Republican states in the country, the governor is in big trouble and the sitting Republican senator is in trouble.
I think that it's also a case of, did he take an agenda too far? And that is, tax cuts. He had a very, very aggressive tax cut proposal that he got through the legislature. And now the state is short about $350 million in revenue, and it's beginning to hurt schools. So, you know, there are consequences to these things. He's called his agenda a great living experiment.
Jennifer Duffy, she's senior editor of the Cook Political Report. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go back to the phones to DeWitt, Michigan. Hi, Lisa. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I guess I just have a comment, and your panel can then share their thoughts. For me, the biggest issue in this election is education and the cuts that our current governor has made to education funding. One of the first things he did when he came in was take a lot of money away from public education. And while he's put a little bit of it back over the last 4 years, the funding levels are still lower than when there was a Democrat in office.
Alan Greenblatt, do you want to comment?
Yeah, if you were looking for one issue that was really important across these races, education leaps out. I mean, we were just talking about Sam Brownback and the state being short. Well, he not only took away teacher tenure, but he cut education. Georgia, Pennsylvania, Florida, Arizona, Michigan. I mean, race after race, a lot of the dialogue is about whether education was cut too much. There's a lot of debate. Sometimes the governors say, I only cut the rate of growth. I didn't really cut it. There's more money, et cetera. But they are talking about education. You have to remember, these governors have presided over a time of retrenchment for states. They're still about half the states that don't have the revenue levels that they did in 2008 before the recession. So they've cut hundreds of thousands of teachers, and people have felt those cuts.
We have an email that says, don't write Texas off. It does no good for those of us in the small minority who will one day be the majority vote. Stu.
That could well happen one day, but the day is not today, nor will it be this November.
Okay. And to you, Larry, you've written that if all the incumbents who are in close contests right now actually lost, we would tie a modern record. Talk about that record.
Yes. Well, it was back in 1962 in a less polarized time, and that's why you had five Democrats and six Republicans losing. Now, you're going to have a mixed bag in this November election for governor, too. I doubt the overall balance, the net balance, changes that much. It's 29 Republicans, 21 Democrats currently. Democrats may pick up a couple net. Republicans may pick up one or two net. We'll have to see how it turns out. But in the individual state, obviously, where a switch occurs, it matters. It's also going to matter for presidential contenders in 2016 for the nominations. Governors can have a big influence on who gets the delegates from their state. Governors have much less influence in a general election.
Alan Greenblatt, do you want to speak to that?
Well, even if we don't break the modern record, we're going to have a lot of upheaval. I learned from Larry's site, the crystal ball, that we haven't had more than four governors lose in a single year since 1990. So there is a lot of discontent at this level of politics. I mean, we haven't even touched on, for instance, Massachusetts, a blue state where the Democrat is tied and support may be slipping. I mean, people do not seem happy with the status quo. We've alluded to the jobs issue a little bit. I just wanted to say we've had callers from Michigan, and Rick Snyder had an ad saying, we're on the road to recovery for every Michigander. He said, you might not feel it yet, but you will soon. And it was really not a happy days are here again kind of message. I mean, there's still a sense that the economy isn't working and that there may be more jobs in the state than when the governor took over, but there aren't enough jobs.
What's the biggest surprise out there, or the biggest potential surprise? Stu Rothenberg.
For governor races, Well, I can look at this list of incumbents or candidates and see a bunch. Scott Walker, there was a time when we were assuming that he'd win this race easily and enter the presidential race. Then the race became even. Then he pulled out ahead. Now it's even again. The fact Kansas has a competitive race. Amazing. Connecticut and Massachusetts could possibly go Republican. The list goes on.
Lots of surprises.
Yeah, you agree.
I agree, and I'll even add what's going on in Alaska right now. With that, shouldn't be a close race. I'll throw in Georgia, where Nathan Deal is seeking a second term. I didn't expect to have that in my toss-up column. So this has been a cycle of the unpredictable.
Okay, surprise question for all of you. Do you expect the Senate to go to Republicans? Larry Sabato. Yes or no?
Yes, I think it will. We could go into the exact numbers, but that would take another hour.
Alan Greenblatt.
Yes, I think it will be a Republican Senate.
And Jennifer.
Yes, barely.
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 And Stu Rothenberg.
Yes, I think that's more likely than not, but it's not quite yet a done deal. But still, it could be a pretty good Republican year.
All right. Stuart Rothenberg, Larry Sabato, Jennifer Duffy, Alan Greenblatt, thank you all so much. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Natalie Urev-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington, D.C. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Zurich, providing